Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hello everyone, it is the Redmen Weekly Podcast, where we wrap up some of the amazing stuff that we've been producing across our whole array of content and channels this week. First and foremost, let's start on a negative, but one that needs to be discussed. The lads in the studio on the Final Word show doing what went wrong with Liverpool Arsenal.
It's the first Premier League game really that we've lost that Liverpool deserve to lose really. It was the I don't think there's much between the teams anyway, but on the day the team who turned up got ended up with all 3 points. We'll go through the incidents, but yeah, Liverpool can't really argue too much about this one. You know, they didn't really deserve anything from that game.
No, sometimes you get what you deserve, don't you, in football? And I think if you look at all of the different parts and scenarios within the game, I think Arsenal are better than us at everything. I don't think we came out on top in any one area. There are certain players within our team that come away with a little bit of credibility, and I'm sure we'll get to that. But I just speaking about it off air, I think that the way we play and the way Arsenal play suits them better, certainly at home, because their transition and getting the ball out wide goes completely against our playing with defensive risk. And last three games, including yesterday, I think they can get the game won early. And that's a feature of the games. They come at us really quick from the word go. We don't react to that particularly well. We haven't in the last two games down there. Okay, we got out of the FA Cup game with a positive result. But there were times in the first half that didn't look likely, did it? And it was a kind of a repeat. And we didn't learn our lessons. And I just thought, look, it's going to happen throughout the season. You're going to get the odd game when it's off. Just happened to be Arsenal, and what it's now done is opened up the media with this. Now it's a three-horse race and players taking photographs and all that on the pitch. It's a bit mad, but we got what we deserved yesterday.
Absolutely. You can lose games to good teams. Let's talk about the team news, Peter, if you don't mind, because I feel like this is a major part. This one is that, do you think there was just one too many where it isn't the team Jürgen would have wanted? If he'd went to Arsenal, that's not the team he'd have wanted. So the main one, of course, is no Salah. But then you take Szoboszlai out late on as well. Nunes probably isn't fit enough to start. You know, God bless him. Conor Bradley's missing as well. He might well have started that game, because it didn't quite look like Alexander-Arnold was 100%. He got taken off after an hour. It does feel like, and obviously Endo's away. Do you think it just felt like there was one too many? If you said to Jürgen, add one of those lads I mentioned, then he'd have been a lot happier, because it just feels like there was, yeah, just it wasn't the team he'd have picked if he had that choice.
Yeah, I think he always says about how you need like a full week to prepare, don't you? So I think obviously coming off a Chelsea game, it's already less preparation time. But then as you say, adding on late things like Conor Bradley, where obviously there's no fault of anyone, Nunes, which, you know, we saw him pictures of him, so we're all hoping, but obviously he wouldn't have said he was in had a problem if he didn't have one, and then Szoboszlai must have been late. So I think to have such a short amount of preparation time for the game like Arsenal away, and then add on three late injury or fitness or absentee problems, then that obviously doesn't help. But as you say, I think it's been papered over that we've had so many injury problems because we've been playing so well. So obviously, as soon as you don't win a game, it obviously is easier to say, oh, you know what, we really could have done with those extra men. But I think Szoboszlai felt like the big miss, yeah. Not against Gravenberch, but it just felt like the game where we really needed him. And then obviously, you know, Thiago was not ready. Maybe Elliot's not physical enough for a game like that. It just felt like we were a bit short there, didn't it? But I think in terms of what we had left, it wasn't much of a surprise. But yeah, I think obviously Trent wasn't fully fit. Robbo was still not fully there, and it was all a bit mismatched, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It's a very technical team, Steve. If you go, you know, Jones, McAllister, Gravenberch, Diaz, Jota, Gakpo, you can include Trent Alexander-Arnold in that as well. There's not really any explosivity, any real pace, any real power. And it felt like Arsenal had a little bit more of that than us as well. Like, there's a lot of sameness about that front six in particular, whereas like a Szoboszlai or a Nunes or a Salah will offer you, whether it's pace or power or both in some cases. See, that plays a part. Well, where Arsenal, for example, Martinelli is lightning fast, Saka was fast, Declan Rice offers that power as well. From a physical point of view, I think Liverpool usually, when you play Arsenal, want to get into that game where you just can knock it around all you want, but we're a bit more explosive than you, and we've seen that, and we didn't really have that because of the players that were on the pitch.
Totally agree, and I think the position of Havertz was key as well, in terms of we had Gakpo and Gravenberch on the right-hand side, and I'm not going to sort of judge Gravenberch at this stage because sample size isn't big enough, but I haven't seen enough of him, and we don't have the ball in terms of going backwards and working hard. Both Szoboszlai is right up there at the top of the stats for interceptions and defensive recovery runs, and Salah will work backwards as well, as we've seen before. Both those two lads are a little bit of a luxury down that side, and if Trent's not at it, not 100% fit, when they go down there and they get Odegaard drifting towards that side, because that's where the pockets of space are, because Gravenberch isn't working in the right way going backwards, and he's still got to learn. Klopp's sides are hard to play in the midfield in a Klopp side because of what he asks of you. He hasn't got it yet. And then obviously the Martinelli threat's always been a threat against them, and then they've got Havertz who's drifted into that area. I think you're right. I think the physicality was a big thing, and they were just at it. They just played totally on the front foot. They suffocated everything we tried to do. And when you need lads to stand up, be counted and be physical and do what you've just said, saying like, we'll just overpower you in the end, that wasn't there. And it was right from the word go, that was a clear, once we put the team out, once they had an inkling in Arsenal of who we would play, they just set up to play in pretty much entirely down that side.
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting, Pete, I don't want to spend too much on it, you can gloss over it. Liverpool scored after like 30 seconds.
Yeah,
like Jota genuinely, against, he is so close to getting that kind of cannons off, isn't he? But like, he's the man you'd want there as well. It just didn't quite fall for him. But like, you talk about fast starts, and after this moment, Arsenal kind of got on top. But Liverpool went miles away there from really landing a really early blow. And it's the man you'd have wanted to fall to as well. He just maybe just come a little bit too early in the game, because I know it's hard lines, but like, you kind of half expect him to do better in that situation as well.
Yeah, well, I think especially the way it bobbled to him against Chelsea, could swap those two instances around, obviously easy to say now, that's what you do, wouldn't you? But one of them, I think it comes too early is what they say, and stuff like that. Obviously you'd hope they're just ready at any moment, but I think, I don't really ever like quoting them, I think our XG was like 0.04, but you felt like 1 in 10 times, maybe less than that, he would have killed that ball, and then he's pretty much going to score, I'd hope. But as you say, it was a really a half chance, but if he controls that, Jota's form especially, and just him in general, you'd think he'd score. And yeah, that did kind of kill us, because we didn't have a shot on target in our first half, and that was probably a bigger chance than the one that Gabriel handed to us, literally.
So, right. And after that moment, it kind of felt like, it felt like Arsenal had a lot of the ball. They weren't really forcing Alisson into a save. They had the big counter-attack with Martinelli when Saka gets his header wide. And then they get the goal. Again, Liverpool's defender isn't great for it. It's good attacking by Arsenal. But yeah, that, if you look at Liverpool's issue on that goal, there's no solid defensive line. Like, there's no offside to have to be played. Because Kai Havertz running through the middle on his own, pretty much. Listen, I never once thought he was going to score. He just gets a bit of luck. Obviously, it bounces to Saka. But it did feel like Liverpool got kind of done with the Havertz thing of, do you go with him, do you track the runner? And again, it isn't the first time this season where there's been a fella just legging straight down the middle of the pitch, and Liverpool's defensive line hasn't been right.
Well, it's 13 minutes into the game, and it's 13 minutes of something's building, something's growing in terms of momentum for Arsenal. And it's normally Konate that dives out with the back four and leaves you a little bit exposed, but this time it's Verge, and we find there's too much distance between the centre-backs. We were speaking about it before we went on air. If you put these two centre-backs where they should be, in between the lines of the box, and then draw your full-backs in, there's no danger. But I think it's born out of frustration. Something's got to change. We've got to do something to try and stop this from happening. So Virgil goes to try and nick it, and we do try and nick balls defensively, because then we can release it and get on the front foot and go in our own quick transition. And he dives out, and then you're right, Havertz doesn't look very convincing there. It's what we've come to expect from Alisson. It's a one-on-one. It's a great save, and it just breaks, luckily, for Saka, and Konate's not that far away from getting to it. But 13 minutes into the game, and you've given yourself a hill to climb because you tried something, you took a risk. I mean, you and I speak about our risk defence quite a lot, don't we? You dive out there, and you get it wrong. You centre backs are in different postcodes. You're in trouble, aren't you?
Yeah. And that's the thing, Peter, isn't it? Is that it's a very other bad game. He missed after you know he's probably at fault for all three goals, at least two of them. The third one maybe as well, because maybe he can come in fit, come in better. But on that one, it does feel like he gets drawn into Havertz. He falls for the trap, really, and it's not there for him. And usually, he's the one who doesn't do that. He's usually the one who... Sometimes he looks too deep because, like Steve said, someone else has ran past them. But again, Arsenal get a little bit of luck from it, don't get me wrong, the way he falls to Saka. But his touch is good, he finishes it. But again, looking at it, like, Arsenal played well, but if you look at all the goals, and we'll talk through them, they didn't have to work that hard for them. Like, they weren't creating loads. You can see why they struggled for goals. You know, the narrative was, these need a striker because they haven't got one. It wasn't like they were that effective, but they were knocking on the door constantly. They were asking questions, and it just felt in a couple of moments Liverpool just kind of let them get away with it a bit.
Yeah, I think when you're a centre back, and obviously me playing six a side is a lot different to what Van Dijk and that do. But I think when you're not marking anyone, that can sometimes be harder than having a Darwin Nunes up against you, because you're waiting for something to happen. As you said, it was a move born out of frustration. They weren't sure what they should be doing, type thing, and obviously they want to make an impact. We weren't doing great with their press; they were attacking us quite well, so it was tough for us to try and maybe just try and make an impact on the game. That's what they were trying to do, weren't they? And I think that obviously is telling. But then maybe you give credit to Arteta, because obviously he's played Jorginho and Rice further back, and then basically Havertz is operating in like a box midfield with Odegaard. And I think, you know, obviously we'll go on to, we tried to counteract that a bit, but I think that was effective against us, because as you say, it brought the fullbacks out wide and the centre backs didn't really know where to go. And then, as you say, all it takes is one lapse in concentration, which we're not used to seeing from Van Dijk, but that's what happened. And then I think Zinchenko makes the good pass to let Odegaard put him through, but as you say, it felt very avoidable.
Absolutely. Before we talk on the next one, I want to ask you a question, Steve, because why do you think Joe Gomez is playing inverted and not Alexander-Arnold in that game? Because I don't know if it's because Bradley was meant to play and it was a late tactical decision that they thought they can't change, but I found it really odd that Liverpool couldn't get on the ball, really, and the best player who they want on the ball couldn't get on the ball, and there seems to be a lot of Joe Gomez in the middle of the pitch. That is quite curious, isn't it?
You have to give Arteta some credit. I spoke a minute ago about where he played Havertz. There's no room for Trent to come in and be inverted there.
But Gomez was doing it, was trying to do it, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was on the other side, because they don't normally Odegaard that's over that side a bit more, but because they thought they'd get their joy down our right-hand side, their left, they sort of set themselves up to be lopsided in that area. And listen, Joe Gomez is quite good on the ball. It was surprisingly so. You know, who knew he was as good a footballer as he is in terms of playmaking and passing through the lines and giving decent balls to people in right areas to hurt the opposition. But I think in terms of the numbers of bodies in that area, it was difficult for Trent to get in there. And I take your point before, I'm not sure Trent's anything like match fit at the moment. So what you've got is what you want from him, and this is an odd one on the team selection, is to pick up the ball and launch a 60, 70 yard ball into the channel for Nunes to go after. You don't get that from the front three on down that right hand side the way we played it. You know, we should maybe have swapped Jota and Gakpo around. I don't know. It's hard to say at this stage, but I think purely because of the tactics Arsenal deployed, there's no room for Trent to go in there. He doesn't become a spare man in there, because all he's doing is playing in the area that Havertz is occupying.
It's interesting, Pete, because Liverpool actually got him on the ball, because you mentioned about like counteract and stuff. I actually thought Liverpool, they stemmed the flow. They weren't attacking well. They weren't having a shot, but like it felt like they were at least getting up the pitch a little bit. They were getting out, and some of that was from Trent, a couple of crosses into the box. So it did kind of work. But going back to the question I asked earlier about like technical players, we didn't see a lot of Liverpool's number eight, either defensively or offensively. They couldn't get them the ball. The press wasn't really on. And it felt like Arsenal were really dominating in there, like Jones, Gravenberch. I thought McAllister was all right, but those two, it wasn't obvious that they're even on the pitch. You know what I mean? Like, again, maybe not all their fault, but also like, you know, it might be a little bit as well. What did you make of the 2-8 there? Because it did feel like they were quite anonymous, both defensively and offensively, really.
Yeah, I thought Curtis Jones played okay, to be fair. I'm not saying he was like any man of the match, right? But I thought, you know, he was being brave and he was trying to take men on, which obviously is stuff that you need in games like that, don't you? And I think you got to credit him a bit, but as you say, it was easy to forget they were both on the pitch, which isn't really what you want to say about your midfield, is it? And obviously, again, it's easy to say the people we were missing, and that's kind of what it felt like. And I know they said to Klopp after, like, did it feel like you were missing one too many? But that was one of the first times where it really felt like, right, we can change this at half time, but who are you bringing on? It's just like, Thiago in 5 weeks' time, you say just get him on half time, but you just knew he wouldn't be ready. And as you say, I think Klopp said his instruction was for Trent to be wider and wider, and it did work towards the end of the second half. And obviously, I know we'll go on to it, and it was Gravenberch who made, although obviously Diaz does most of it, who made that chance for Diaz that led to the goal. So obviously they were involved, but yeah, we definitely lost the midfield battle, and it took a while for us to get back in on top of it.
I was surprised there, maybe, I was trying to figure out why this question I'll ask you again is like, what Ryan Gravenberch done to be ahead of Harvey Elliott in the pecking order? I find that curious. My only thing I could think of is that he's tall and Arsenal are a big team, and maybe yeah. they scored a set play at Anfield, but I can't think for any rhyme or reason other than that why Gravenberch would start. And listen, I'm with you, it's too early to write him off. He's had good games, he's had poor games. You can say the same about Harvey Elliott a little bit as well, and Harvey's been a good sub, I understand it. But if I'm Harvey Elliott, I'm thinking, okay, no Sobers, like, there's a couple, obviously, Endo's out, blah, blah, blah. I probably should be starting that game. If I'm him, I'd be disappointed that the manager has picked Gravenberch, because if you're asking who's had a better season so far, you would probably say it would be Elliott. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's fair. And you might have something with the height point you make there, because both managers would have second guessed what the opposition were going to do. And Gravenberch is about 6'1", 6'2", isn't he? And Harvey's like 5'9". So from a set-piece perspective, you're quite right. And I think Arsenal lead the way on set-piece goals this season, don't they, in the Premier League? So I think that they're very much thinking about that. My issue with that, and it's a good point you raise, is that Harvey looks after the ball really well. And he's a front-foot player, so his first touch is to get the ball out of his feet and look forward. Gravenberch sometimes is looking at the ball and not what's going on around him a little bit, and it's still growing into the role, growing into what we do at Liverpool. It might be like Fabinho struggled for months, didn't he, before it sort of clicked, and that might be the case with Gravenberch. But I think we speak about, or everybody speaks about, what's Harvey's role. Is he an impact sub? Is he unlucky not to start? I think he could be a little bit frustrated not starting yesterday. You know, he comes on and he doesn't get in the game, but the game's a strange one by the time he comes on. I think he would have given us maybe a little bit more balance, because he understands what's expected of a player in that position, because he's been at the club for a while now and he's good at it. But on the flip side, when he has started games, I think he's struggled to have an impact. He's more of a comes off the bench and revitalises that area of the pitch, because he does everything that Klopp asks him to do. So it's a difficult one. I don't think if you play, it changes much if you play him there, to be honest with you. So it's an interesting team selection point. I don't think it makes a difference in terms of how the game panned out.
Yeah. I suppose, I'm just thinking, Pete, because Gravenberch has often played on the left. Like, it's been Szoboszlai and Elliott, and then it's been Gravenberch or Jones. Now it's been Jones predominantly, and rightly so, Jones has deserved it. But it was interesting that not only, like, again, I can only imagine it's the height thing, because that's Harvey's position. If Szoboszlai isn't fit, Harvey is the next right side date. He just is. Yeah. It's not really Ryan Gravenberch. He's the left side date, and he's been playing behind Curtis. Again, Steve might be right. It might be nothing, but also you think there's probably a little bit more of an understanding between a Jota and a Trent and an Elliott or a Gakpo or whatever you do. Because all of a sudden, Liverpool are playing a right hand side of Gravenberch, Gakpo, Alexander Arnold. I don't know how often that's happened. Probably not much. It just felt like, and it kind of felt like that as well. There was no rhythm, or no one really was quite sure what each other was doing. It's just a curious one. Again, hindsight's 2020, and if Liverpool win 2-1, and then you're not really talking about it. But it is, I don't know, I kind of feel for Harvey there, because I feel like he deserved that place, because it's his place. You know, that's where he plays.
Yeah. But I think Klopp said after as well, what you're saying then, like, that was a right triangle that never played together before. And obviously, you know how important that is to pass it. But I think the respect he has for Martinelli might have had something to do with it, because I think his pace is obviously, it's unlivable. You can't live with it. Sorry, obviously, we saw Konate, who's definitely not slow. He got absolutely roasted by Martinelli, didn't he? And I think one thing Harvey Elliott doesn't have is pace. I think he saw that for their third goal. He's running against Trossard, who I don't think is unbelievably quick, and like, he got outpaced by him. So I wonder whether, knowing Trent's not fully fit, you want that more physical person who can then run back and hopefully help. But it didn't seem like Gravenberch did that either, but maybe that was part of the thinking. But yeah, if you're Harvey Elliott, you would be thinking, you know, I don't think he ever goes into any game against Arsenal away thinking I should be starting. But when you look at the people who are missing, then he has case to say I should definitely have been playing ahead of Ryan Gravenberch. But obviously it was a decision that was made. I think that's all I can think of it would be to try and cope with the pace of Martinelli, but obviously didn't necessarily work, did it?
No, absolutely. I think it's fair to say, Steve, like, I'm not casting judgment on it. Like, I'm not writing the lad off. But Ryan Gravenberch has been a little bit underwhelming at times. Like, he arrived, because it's worth mentioning, on deadline day.
Yeah.
So he's had no pre-season with Liverpool. He hasn't played for a year. You can see there's clearly something about him at times. His close control is fantastic. He's got a bit about him. He actually gets in the box a lot and he's actually scored a few goals. But I don't know, that's a big game to put someone who's in patchy form into, isn't it? You know what I mean? Like, what have you made of Gravenberch over the last couple of weeks? Because he's been given a lot of opportunities. He's mentioned that, you know, it's the reason he came when he wanted minutes. He has been given them. I think it's fair to say he hasn't exactly lit the place on fire just yet. We're not writing him off and saying, like, he's going to be crap or nothing, but he hasn't had, like, he hasn't had the hit the ground start like a Szoboszlai's had, or vice, you know, Endo maybe had a little bit of this as well. It kind of feels like of all the summer signings, he's been the one who you're still waiting to explode.
Yeah, I think it's horses for courses with him, and Arsenal's probably not a course you'd put him over.
I agree. Yeah.
You want Szoboszlai would have been ideal there because we mentioned before his recovery runs and his physicality. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant in tight spaces with the football, but there were no tight spaces to give him the football in yesterday. And
yeah.
I often reference you've got to give good footballers the ball in areas where they can hurt people, and we certainly didn't do that. So yeah. I'm not going to pile in on Gravenberch. I'm not saying you are, but I'm not going to pile in on Gravenberch. But over the last few weeks, the one question that doesn't go away for me is what do we get from him when we don't have the ball?
Yeah.
And that's key for a Liverpool midfield. That's why the legs fell off the previous one, because we ask so much of them.
Yeah.
And sometimes I think ball watching is the wrong phrase, because that's been overcritical. I think the game can pass him by. I think he's more of an offensive player than he is a workhorse, a defensive player. We've got Burnley coming up at home. That might be a great game for him, because he'll get more time on the ball and be able to showcase what he does. I think, looking back on it, and you say 2020 hindsight and all that, I think all of us, to a man, would have said prior to the Arsenal game, is that going to work, having him there? Is there not anybody else who can go into that pocket and sit there? You know, if you know, you mentioned Conor Bradley in their situation, you'd have played Trent in there before you played and put Bradley at right back.
Yeah.
If you'd have had those options, you could have played Gomez at right back, put Trent in midfield and played Robertson. But then how close to being match fit is Robertson? It didn't look it when he came on. So I think for Gravenberch, I think the jury's out. What we paid for him is a no-risk fee. So if in 18 months' time we decide, look, this isn't working, you get your money back. Somebody goes somewhere and you get your money back. So I hope that isn't the case, because technically he's an amazing footballer, but we need to see a little bit more from him. We need to understand his responsibilities, and we don't have the ball. This is like Coutinho, where everyone's like, Coutinho is boss, but you could run off Coutinho all day long, couldn't you? You could overload down that side, and that's what happens with Gravenberch. So a bit of work to do on the training pitch in terms of if you're not going to track someone, learn to mark space better than he is doing, be in an area where they can't put the ball in. He's not doing either particularly well at the moment.
As always, don't forget you can check these full shows out by going to redmenplus.com and sign up, get them in video and in podcast form. We move on then to the Biased Football Podcast, always a bit of light-hearted fun looking at the rest of the league. But this week it focused on Unai Emery and his suitability for the soon-to-be vacant Liverpool managerial hot seat.
The same could be said for Unai Emery. I'm not, as much as I like him, if you're going to ask the question, I don't think that's a fit.
Is he on your shortlist?
No.
What about you, Sting?
No.
Yeah, absolutely is. Wins in Europe. Good manager.
Bit of an underdog guy.
But I love the underdog story.
But we're not that anymore.
I don't care. I want to be that.
He did okay in Paris as well. He did win in Paris.
Yeah, but again,
the Arsenal thing tarnished him. He was all right at Arsenal. He got them to a final, by the way.
Yeah.
He couldn't say V in good evening, and then people were racist and xenophobic against them. That's where he got sacked from there. He doesn't know if he does fuck
no,
all.
No, I get that. I
think, mate, he'd be good at us.
I will hear bad words said about him. I think he's brilliant. I've said it countless times on this podcast. I think he's brilliant. I just doesn't feel like a Liverpool fit.
I think sometimes he's been pegged as this, like, defensive manager, but it's not. Villa aren't defensive now. No. They're good at the back. And they work more, like, but they attack with verve, and like, he plays a proper striker with two proper wingers and a number 10. They're a very attacking side. John McGinn is invited to get forwards. He is not like a park the bus manager who wins, like, 1-0 games. Like, he's not that. He does go for it. I think he wouldn't be my first choice, but if Liverpool have him on their shortlist, then I'd be fine. I'd rather have him than the Zerbi, for example. Yeah.
Yes,
sorry. I think I kind of know where Dan's going with his point, and I agree with you two as well. I'd definitely have him on there. There's like a, can he do the full possession? We're going to have 70% of the ball and dominate a league campaign. That's the question mark for me.
I think he can, yeah.
And I'm not sure he can, because I've not seen him do it. I didn't see his parasite. Maybe you did and you know differently to
but
me.
Just the best
what I've seen him is very much counter-attacking football until he got to Villa. And it's not all singing, all dancing, we're going to take the ball off you for 70% of the time. At Villa, it's still quick transitions, and we don't get very many opportunities to do that. So I'd have him on my shortlist, definitely. I'd be really interested. And it's whether you believe he can make that step up. You do. Chloe, what do you think?
I'm just one of them where I want the next manager. I want to be able to buy into everything that I stand. Like, I just want someone who I think... I adore you. I think you're boss and the way you play football is class. And I get that with Unai Emery. I think he can do that. I mean, he went up against Manchester City and Arsenal and
had three games break
and literally took the mick out of Manchester City. So, and they probably did have a lot of possession in that game because Manchester City had like one shot. Villa had like 19 or something silly. And then they showed the other side of them against Arsenal where they had to go toe-to-toe with them and they bullied them and they showed the tenacity and they showed that I'm bullying you off the ball. I'm better than you. I'm stronger than you. And you've got to see two different sides of Unai Emery's team. You've also got to see the counter-attacking side of it and the quality they use. Liverpool are unbelievable in transition. You know, you think of some of the goals. I mean, Everton springs to mind a lot where they've hit the post and all of a sudden in 30 seconds we've got the ball in the back of the net. Unai Emery's side do that. Unai Emery's side are really good in transitions, and that's why Liverpool are also really good in transitions as well. And sometimes we've had to do that. So yeah, I think Unai Emery should be on the shortlist. Is he my number one candidate? No, but if he was named as the next Liverpool manager, I'd be like, yeah, I'd give it a go.
It's interesting for my list.
It's interesting because Xabi Alonso's on most people's shortlist. He's probably top of most people's like wanted list. What's he done that Emery's not done?
No, exactly. He hasn't won 4 Europa Leagues.
No.
Hasn't won a league title. Hasn't shown that he can manage in the Premier League. Like, I get the Alonso thing and I think he'd probably still be my choice if I'm giving it, but I think...
Yeah, in pure black and white terms.
Yeah, like, Emery's he's a fantastic manager. He did a decent job at Arsenal. It was just a mad time to take over that football team. He got left a bit of a shambles. He still got into the European final. As well, it was the circumstances around that was all mad why he got sacked. But mate, I think he's fantastic. I think he's absolutely brilliant. Yeah. I've been saying it for 2 years now. I think he's brilliant. His teams are so well organised, but they're not. I'll go back to it. They don't just counter attack. They can play that game again. Watch that game against City. That's a team who can play footy.
No, I agree with you. But then
why wouldn't he be on the list?
I can't say he was on the list.
No, I'm sorry. I'm hypothesising to the group. Why wouldn't he be on your list? I don't understand.
He has no feel to me as a Liverpool manager whatsoever. Honestly, I can't stress that enough.
I think he's got something dramatically missing. He's got Benitez qualities though, in that and we got behind Benitez. If you win. But like he's not Jürgen, he's not the fist bumps, crowd pump up, but like I still think he connects with the Villa fans. The Villa fans love him.
Yeah, they do.
Absolutely. I'm a Liverpool fan and I love that.
I love Unai Emery. I love him.
Doesn't sound like it, Dan.
He's just not a Liverpool manager in waiting.
None of us believe that you love Unai Emery.
Everything you're saying other than I love him suggests that you don't love him.
I'll get a tattoo of Unai Emery.
I love my wife. Meanwhile, you're banging some baby. I love my wife, honestly. He's out bevying every night. Party with different girls.
There's something dramatically missing for me. And maybe it's because I'm so invested in Xabi Alonso. Not necessarily.
Why is Xabi Alonso a better manager than Unai Emery? I think he might be. But he might not be.
No, but I think, and I'm willing to take that risk on Xabi Alonso.
Because my
biggest concern in life right now is that Xabi Alonso might be the next big thing and Liverpool don't get him right now. Because all of a sudden the Real Madrid hot seat becomes available, or the Bayern Munich one, and he goes there and he's absolutely mustard.
I agree with that, but if you ask for a CV for Liverpool manager, can he win trophies? Yeah. Is he managing the Premier League?
which is helpful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has he won European? Has he had European success? Yeah.
No, I get it.
Are the signings good? Yeah.
I'm almost certain.
There's not many managers apart from Emery that are on that.
No. Did he play good footy? Yeah. Like, that's a...
He ticks loads of boxes.
If you're doing like a Venn diagram of all those things, you're like, Emery's right in the middle.
There's an intangible here. There's an intangible here. And Jurgen Klopp has that intangible in absolute bucket loads. I don't think Emery does.
See, I don't think... I don't know, man. Because, like... I don't think Xabi Alonso is going to be that either. He's a different.
This goes back to the point that Keogh made last week on the podcast. Is that you're not going to get another Shankly, so it doesn't have to be someone like Jurgen Klopp. Paisley wasn't Shankly, and that difference can still achieve success.
Okay, so say Xabi Alonso says, "Don't fancy it." Would you be okay with Emery? Or would there be someone else on that?
Because it feels like
you're very much invested. And I get the Alonso thing, I get it. But if he says, I'm off to Real Madrid, lads. Soz, I love Liverpool, but Real Madrid want me. If he does a Jude Bellingham, then...
I'd still have managers ahead of
who
Yeah, I'd like to know who that is.
Okay.
And if De Zerbi comes out,
Ancelotti's on my very short list.
Yeah, I just don't think he comes and does it. No,
I think he comes just to put a red Christmas tree up.
Yeah, well, he moved out of Liverpool because he always got robbed. I don't think he's fancy coming back here.
He'd love him in charge of us. He'd love to stick it to Everton as well.
He would, but also, I think he fucked off the second he could.
Yeah, I don't know. I keep going back to this man, but I've got a Julian Nagelsmann ahead of.
I'd rather honestly shoot myself in the face.
I do.
He's fucking capable.
I think
you're talking personality that doesn't fit with Liverpool. Nagelsmann's at the top.
He is the perfect Chelsea manager. And he's,
yeah, exactly. That's why I pigeonholed him with Chelsea before. I think we're at a point now whereby we might need something slightly removed because Jurgen Klopp leaving is such a big deal. Of course, we need someone a little bit younger, up and coming, that's going to take this club forward for the next few years.
See, I think that should be the next one. I think the next fella coming in should just win.
Yes.
Everything's built for him to just win. Win now. Ancelotti would be fucking... He's not going to happen, but Ancelotti's the perfect...
I don't think that exists.
Here's this team I've built.
Outside of Ancelotti, Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola, that person doesn't exist.
It might be Emery.
Spalletti should be on that list.
Potentially everyone.
Mourinho's the other one who's one of them.
Yeah,
he's still in there.
But I don't want to... I'll see you next Tuesday. That's my problem. Him and Nagelsmann are both one of them. I've found it mad for a while that Emery hasn't been linked more.
He hasn't even been mentioned. This is the first time I'm hearing his name mentioned.
It's baffling.
He's not been mentioned at all.
No. It's been Alonso, De Zerbi and Thomas Frank.
Ruben Amorim as well. Ruben Amorim is sporting.
He's not my... Unai Emery's not number one on my list, but out of the managers that you've just said, he'd top all of them.
Thomas Frank?
I'd have Alonso.
He's supposed to be highly thought of, isn't he?
Highly thought of.
Yeah.
I'd put Unai Emery above Thomas Frank. Oh,
100%.
I might be talking myself
into Emery should be the favourite.
Really?
I'm getting close to it.
Ahead of Xabi Alonso.
That's the only difference. If Xabi Alonso hadn't played for Liverpool, I don't think this is a conversation.
I've just said a minute ago, we want this young up and coming manager.
That's a very much royal week.
I want this young up and coming manager who could be the next best thing.
Yes,
to be the guy. But... And we've all invested in Xabi Alonso, so therefore we all want that.
I'm not convinced Xabi Alonso's the guy.
Really?
I think
Xabi Alonso could be the guy.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward to May, June then. Liverpool are about to appoint the next manager after Jurgen Klopp to succeed.
And Xabi Alonso just won the Bundesliga.
What's the name? Well, no, forget it. What's the name that you want to hear?
Carlo Ancelotti. It is.
Pep Guardiola available. Like, I don't know. This is tough, man. I think Alonso is going to be a good manager. I know Unai Emery is a good manager. And that's it.
Do you rather Unai Emery?
No, I'm not saying that because I don't know. My head's gone because... because if Alonso hadn't played for Liverpool,
it would be Unai Emery. I'm terrified of Alonso being boss and not getting him.
That's kind of what happens
if we do get him and he's crap.
He's not crap.
I don't think he's crap. But also move on.
It's just not Liverpool's level. Okay.
Who think you're playing a European competition next year?
Come on,
Emery or Alonso?
Let me answer at the end of the season because Leverkusen might win a European.
That's true. Yeah. They're doing well.
That's
fair.
If I was
picking the next Liverpool manager, I'd probably pick Xabi Alonso. But Unai's very
I've been sold on Xabi Alonso for a while, but this since is
purely,
it came out.
So. Purely on emotion, and that's the reason I'm not picking Unai Emery.
No, I don't think so. It's the opposite.
I was picking on emotion, I think I'd pick
Alonso's
Unai Emery.
The emotion for me.
Yeah,
we're picking Alonso on emotions.
Yeah,
not picking Unai Emery on that.
Yeah, okay.
Because he doesn't have that.
Okay.
You know what I mean? He doesn't have that.
He has the CV.
He has the CV, exactly.
It's tough, man. It's tough.
So in black and white.
Why do you think he isn't being mentioned?
I don't know, to be honest with you. But like, are we really just like, if you could get Ancelotti, would you still have Alonso?
No.
I'd have Ancelotti, of course. But I don't think.
Yeah, there you go. Of course.
But I don't think he's an option.
No.
Would you though? How long is he going to do it for?
I don't care. I will have put him in the league like twice, and then I'm fine with the future. The future will take care of itself.
No, I'm not.
The thing is, I think Liverpool will go for a young manager.
So I do as well,
and that rules out a lot of the people that we're speaking about already. Yeah. Like, I think Spalletti's a brilliant manager,
yeah,
but he's in his 60s, so I don't think Liverpool are going anywhere near him because we've just had a lad retire who's in his 50s. Basically, it's too tough for.
Yeah.
I think you need to be ahead of the curve. Yeah. And everything from the last 10 or 12 years of what Liverpool have done data-wise is being ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And that's why Alonso makes sense for what Liverpool are looking for.
Agreed.
Yeah.
They're looking for somebody to go
exactly like that with.
Yeah. Like, and based on our transfer policy, FSG, by a rule, don't buy sort of 30 to Endo and Thiago exceptions.
So that's
course.
Emery, that's Spalletti, exactly. That's all of them out.
Someone who's
but
about
it brings
to
in your Nagelsmanns, your Alonso's, your Tuchel.
It rules out a lot of good managers.
It does.
Yeah.
Somebody who's about to hit their peak and could burst
exactly.
at some
that's
point.
That's what Liverpool will be
that's
looking
what
at.
We're looking for. That's what we do with players. That's where I'm at.
But it's not what I would do if it was my money and I was in charge of Liverpool. I'd go and get someone who guarantees me trophies and that guy is Ancelotti. Or Pep Guardiola.
They're not available, are they? That's the thing.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It's a good conversation. It is a good conversation. But I'm so in on Xabi Alonso, it hurts.
I just need to watch more of him, and I've got that plan for tonight because we're doing a show on him on Wednesday on the deep dive also, and on his tactics and stuff.
Leverkusen Munich on the weekend. Yeah, five kickoff.
We will be there.
It's going to be a belt episode.
The biased football podcast there turns a bit biased.
Well, it's better than talking about Newcastle 4, Luton 4.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome, like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Yep, there you go. And then, of course, Neil Jones was in for Journo Insight, as he often is, lifting the lid on Liverpool's reported move to bring Michael Edwards back to the football club.
Michael Edwards reportedly turned down the chance to return to Liverpool. Yeah, this is Chris Bascombe's piece in the Telegraph. It's been in lots of different places. But he says, Liverpool's pursuit of a sporting director suffered a blow with their former chief recruiter, Michael Edwards, snubbing the chance to return to Anfield. He left in 2022, was approached about coming back to the club, but Edwards indicated he has no interest in the position. Obviously, Jörg Schmadtke has now gone. It's effectively a vacant role waiting for somebody. And interestingly, on this one, we're all speaking about who the next manager is going to be. Yeah. Is it going to be Alonso, De Zerbi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? But like, there's a sporting director to be hired as well, which is, I mean, two massive, probably the two biggest footballing positions in the club are the manager and then the sporting director. Liverpool are looking for both at the same time.
Yeah.
Was you surprised he went back to Michael Edwards? Because, I don't know, obviously he left, he set up his own company. He's apparently been doing well. I know there was rumours linking him with other clubs as well, but it looks like he went straight back to him after Jörg Schmeichel decided, it was decided he wasn't staying.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm surprised that he went back to him, because if you're looking at what you need, you know, we need a sporting director who's available, who's, you know, we know the way they work, we trust their judgments, or we whatever their references or anything like that, then Michael Edwards would obviously pop up in your database. I'm surprised he got out a little bit, you know, that the story's sort of come out, because my first sort of instinct was, you know, why would Liverpool wait until they've announced Jurgen Klopp was leaving, or Jurgen's announced that he's leaving, and then go to Michael Edwards that weekend when they've known for obviously six weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it was. But then obviously the story comes out, so you go, well, actually that's probably why, isn't it? Because had you done that in November, this story might have got out, and it would have been, by the way, Jurgen's, you know, it casts doubt over that situation. I think it shows what Liverpool's approach isn't going to change. You know, I don't think Jurgen's departure means that they're gonna suddenly, right, we're gonna go down the sort of the Chelsea Todd Bowley route, and we're gonna start, you know, you're gonna see us spend. I don't think they're gonna recoil and go the other way either. I think they're gonna carry on trying to do what they've been doing, but I also think it shows the challenges they're gonna have doing it, because it depends on people who are very good at their job. Jurgen, Michael Edwards were very good at their job, and B, who can work together and do it. And if you know, you know, we don't know who the next manager is going to be. I have a sort of a leaning that I think it'll probably be Xabi Alonso, but that's all it is. Probably an opinion that it probably should be. But you know, you don't know how he's going to work with a new sporting director. You don't know how the new sporting director is going to want to work with Mike Gordon or whoever else. So there's a lot of up in the air at this moment in time about Liverpool's strategy off the pitch, definitely. But I think what this tells you is it won't be too far away from the approach that they've had in terms of the type of players they target, the way that they work, the sort of the idea of the way the club structured. I think will be pretty similar. If ideally, it just will be different personalities, and that brings with it its own risks.
Absolutely. You mentioned there about, like, we spoke a few weeks ago, rather, and about, like, what comes first, chicken or the egg? What comes first, sporting director or the manager? And it was like, well, Mike Gordon, FSG, are going to pick the manager.
Yeah.
I think we'd all be pretty confident on that one. But it looks like they've gone to the sporting director maybe first, because obviously they haven't made any, as far as we know, they haven't really approached any managers yet. They're probably doing all the work behind the scenes. But they did go to Edwards first. I wonder if that's an indication, maybe that is that the role they want to get done first, or is that just because he's a free agent and it's easier to do that than go and get a Deserbi or Alonso out of the clubs?
Absolutely, and also, you know, you really need to be planning the summer window, don't you? Now,
yeah,
probably.
Well,
should already
Jurgen was saying he was going to be doing
yeah,
it.
So you know, you want to be the manager, you know, really, you only need the manager in place for the first day of pre-season, don't you? You know, in July or whatever, but you want someone doing the sort of the work, the deals, whatever it is, the negotiations, really ASAP in terms of the summer transfer window. So I don't think that has an impact on the managerial appointment. I don't think, you know, it's a case of like, right, Michael, do you fancy the job? By the way, tell us who our next manager should be. I don't think it'll be that. I think Mike Gordon will already be, you know, and whoever, Will Spearman, and the data team will already be a fair way down the road in terms of, at the very least, whittling down candidates or creating a bit of a short list. But yeah, beyond that, there's a lot of stuff that needs doing, isn't there? There's contracts, there's obviously sales, potentially, there's people leaving on freeze, there's new signings that are going to be needed as every summer. So getting the sporting director in as quickly as possible. I'm not sure whether it'll be possible or reasonable to expect that the new manager's sort of known before the end of the season, that we know, okay, Klopp's leaving on this date, and then X is moving in. X actually works, doesn't it? I meant Mr. X. But I'm not sure whether that's reasonable to expect because of obviously all the contracts and
Man United did it, though, to be fair. Ten Hag was announced before the end of the season.
Yeah, they did. So possibly. But I think it's reasonable to expect that Liverpool will have a new sporting director by the end of the season, definitely. And if not, then you would be a bit worried.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you think it matters? Because, like, I know FSG can't, they did this with Klopp and Edwards, like, they weren't, sometimes they come, not come as a team, but, like, you basically, your boss just put you together, like, you're the boss, you're that, and you're working together now.
Yeah.
There's no, like, synergy of, like, would you want him, or do you want him, or do you like him, or not?
No,
comes from above, like, right, he's that, you're that, get on.
Yeah.
It feels like that's the approach they're going to go for, which, again, it seemed it worked last time, don't get me wrong, but also it does run the risk of like personality clashes or, well, who gets the final, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I think a lot comes from that, you know, a lot of the success around Liverpool. I've spoke to people who've been, you know, very close to that. A lot of the success around Liverpool's recruitment policy and strategy came from the personality of those two people.
Yeah.
Really, and Mike Gordon as the third member, really, of the triumvirate, that, you know, they can fall out, they can disagree, but there's no sort of agenda working against each other, you know, and I don't mean that in a sort of, you know, as sinister as that sounds, but there's no kind of, well, the manager's mind is on this and the club's mind is on this. There was a fairly central point where they both were pretty close to. So that is important, of course. You know, you're bringing in two people who've never worked together. I mean, Edwards was already at the club when Jürgen was appointed.
Yeah.
You know, albeit in a different guise. If you are bringing in two brand new appointments who don't know the club, and obviously there's not just the manager, but there's his staff that he might want. He might want different fitness team. They might want different medical team. He might want a different scouting network. Then obviously that leads to some change. And if you've got people who are abrasive or who maybe don't give ground as easily as maybe Jürgen has done at times, or as Michael Edwards has done at times, then you could get that. That is the risk. But I think that's why Liverpool sort of, you know, are taking a time on these things. I think that they'll do all they can to mitigate that sort of risk and get the right characters in. It feels to me like Schmeichel was a decent character in that sense. You know, there was no sort of, didn't feel like there was anything rocking the boat when he was there. It didn't, you know, we never heard from him, did we? We didn't hear. I wondered whether we might have heard a little bit more because he was a German sporting director, whether we might have heard him taking a bit more media.
He's done a lot of media in Germany, didn't he?
Yeah, we never really heard him sort of saying, well, you know, yeah, you know, I'm gonna tell you what happened with Caicedo, or, you know, let me tell you something about, you know, why the manager didn't let me sign this player or whatever it is. We never got any of that. I don't expect that to change. But obviously, when you're bringing in new people whose maybe personality you haven't seen that close up, or you haven't really seen in such a pressurised situation, then there is that risk. And, you know, I think it's right the Liverpool fans do have some concern that, you know, two big vacancies need filling. I think the manager's one, you know, I sort of said this on another show yesterday, but you can't find the perfect solution isn't out there for Liverpool, no matter what, you know.
Yeah.
There's no silver bullet that you go, nailed it. Anyone they bring in, whether they're the most experienced manager in the world or you know, an Alonso, you know, someone like that, there'll be pros and cons to it. You've just got to hope that, you know, you back your judgment and that the potential that you see and the vision that you see for the club is able to play out. I think what you would say is the potential of the club in terms of the playing staff and the infrastructure and the youth setup and all those things, that's big. So there's plenty for any new manager to get stuck into and you know, try and plenty of tools at their disposal, definitely.
Absolutely. Without hypothesising too much, it's kind of half obvious where the story comes from, because Billy Hogan did say at his press conference, we'll do everything behind the scenes, we'll tell you when we're ready. Like, yeah. There'll be no leaks coming from us, so it's obviously coming from the other way. How do you think Liverpool will feel about the fact that this story got out? Because they don't like things like this being in public knowledge. They're not big fans of it. They try and do everything as behind, the right way, really. Obviously, it's come from the other camp that this story's got out for whatever reason. It could be a conversation. It could be any, you know, it doesn't do someone's business any favours, sorry, any harm to have Liverpool link with the names again. But I think Liverpool's response will be, because now whoever does get hired, it's going to be, you know, they ask Michael Edwards first. Yeah. That's always, you know, something that's maybe going to be in the back of minds.
Plus, Possibly, yeah. I mean, I don't think it'll affect the prestige of the job.
No,
from a Liverpool perspective, you know, I don't think there'll be people saying, "Oh, no, I'm not answering the phone when they ring." You know,
second choice.
Yeah, but I think, yeah, I think there would have been a bit of surprise, disappointment, maybe that the story got out. I like I say, I was surprised. You know, I was a bit like, "Oh, you know, that was not what you'd expect." You know, you think of Michael Edwards as
a private man.
Yeah, you know, never gave interviews, did he? You know, you never saw him sort of, everyone uses the same picture of him, don't they, really? To illustrate their articles, because there's not so few of them knocking around. I don't think it'll be a big deal for them. There might have been a sort of couple of raised eyebrows and a tooth or whatever, but, you know, I think it'll be a bit more, you know, it shows, obviously, the importance. And when people ask, why has Jürgen made his announcement now? I think that it tells you that, doesn't it? You know, what's going to happen. Yeah, you know, you sort of, it's a miracle, really, that Liverpool were able to keep that secret for as long as they did. So it explains a little bit why, you know, time and why Jürgen felt like he had to say it publicly. And We're gonna have to deal with a lot more of these. You know, we're already seeing stories this week with Ruben Amorim. We see stories about Chelsea wanting Xabi Alonso. You know, there's going to be all of these things that we're going to have to sort of sift through in the next weeks and months. But I think Liverpool will keep pretty quiet about it. And, you know, I think you've got to back them. Look, you know, as much as it's 9 years ago, virtually 8.5 years ago, the last time they appointed the manager, they got it spot on. Most of the time they've recruited players, they've got it spot on. So I think you've got to trust their track record in this, you know, even if it is a little bit unprecedented in terms of the scale of the job that they've got to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there any other, have we heard anything else reported? Again, probably not, because Liverpool are really good at keeping the secret, but like, there are a couple of names floating about in the Sporting Director stuff, but there's been nothing like official out there.
No.
So everything is going the way Liverpool would like, kind of half wanted to go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think a lot of the stuff, I mean, Tim Steiton was one, wasn't he, that was sort of...
The guy at Bournemouth whose name Hughes, is it? I think I heard.
Yeah, Richard Hughes, yeah. There's a few, you know, it's really hard to know really what a good sporting director is.
Yeah.
Especially for a club like Liverpool, who have a specific way, because we've seen it. Remember, there was a time when Steve Walsh was the number one sporting director, really, you know, in the Premier League, and Jamie Vardy, Riyad Mahrez, N'Golo Kanté, and you thought, wow, what a hit rate. He goes to Everton, and it's a different club, and you've got different demands. There was a time when Newcastle seemed to, you know, they got a lot of publicity for cornering the French market, that they were getting in players who said... Graham Carr, wasn't it, their chief scout, was getting all these players, but that doesn't last forever. So it's a really difficult one to sort of judge, right, he's the sort of perfect candidate for the sporting director, or that's down to the club to deal with that. We can look at it and say, well, his track record is this, and he's been this, and he's worked with these kind of players, and you can put ticks in boxes, but really, you know, until Liverpool sort of show their hand, it's just conjecture at this moment in time. And I don't expect Liverpool to sort of start briefing that, all right, this is our number one sporting director target, we're going to have to Monchi or Richard Hughes or whoever you want to talk about. I think it'll be one of those that it'll emerge when it's pretty much done.
Who's the West Ham guy? Tim Steiton.
Yeah, he was at Leverkusen.
Well, I was about to say, is there anything...
He was linked with Liverpool before Jürgen Schmadtke was appointed.
Yeah, is there anything in the fact that he was with Alonso for a bit, in that if you are looking to fill these two guys and their two massive roles, is there a benefit of bringing in two guys who've worked together before? At least do you...
Possibly, because he didn't work with him for long.
He got off after a bit. He helped hire him.
Yeah, he didn't work with him for long, and he obviously left for West Ham. You know, before Alonso had completed a full season. So how close that relationship is, you don't know. I know there's, you know, you speak to people in Germany and they'll tell you good and bad things about him. You speak to people at West Ham and they'll tell you good and bad things about him. I mean, he's just signed Calvin Phillips on loan.
But he signed Kudus.
But he signed Mohamed Kudus and he signed Edson Alvarez and he got good money for Declan Rice. You know, so there are ticks and crosses in a lot of these people's boxes. Like I say, there's not many sort of ways that people like us can sort of say, well, he's the guy that Liverpool needs to appoint. You know, you can look at people with great track records, Michael Edwards being one, but there's every chance, you know, Michael Edwards jumped at the first opportunity he got and went to Chelsea, and now people are saying, oh, he wasn't that good, was he? You know, like, look at this, he's got all, you know, because of the nature of the club. So a lot depends on the stability of the club, the stability of the relationship with the manager, the strategy of the owners, and the fact that, you know the conditions that you're going to be working in. And I think Liverpool are in a decent position in that regard, because we all sort of know what you're going to be expected to do. You're not going to turn up at Liverpool and they're going to say, oh, by the way, we're going to go, look, we need big, tall, 6'4" sort of experienced players, and we're going to play at a very direct style. You know that Liverpool have got a certain way of, you know, playing football, certain demands in terms of the communication that you need with the fans, certain demands in the type of players that you're going to target. So I think that makes it a little bit easier for them to, you know, A, attract the right kind of candidate, but also find it.
And in another of a sensational expert insight shows, Dan Clubb spoke to Peter Bruckner, former sports scientist at Liverpool Football Club, to discuss why Jurgen Klopp might be feeling burned out and why it might be the right time for him to leave Liverpool.
Liverpool have got a potential over 28 games to come, and we can't be affording to burn out in that time. Jurgen Klopp has got his rest coming up there after he's having a year off, I think he said, suffering from a little bit of an overload and burnout himself. But yeah, for Liverpool between now and then, this is the main reason I wanted to talk to you, really, because how much will Klopp, and indeed the rest of the staff, Pep Linders, be leaning on the sports science department and the fitness department, etc., etc., between now and the end of the season? When it comes to who is fit and available, and as you mentioned earlier on, like, will training suddenly take a massive dip because they are playing so much? Like, this could be the season to end all seasons, essentially. It could be absolutely phenomenal. But how important is it that we get it right from every single possible point of view? Because the marginal gains between now and the end of the season could be absolutely imperative.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge challenge. And everyone's involved. You know, it's the coaches, the fitness staff, the nutrition, massage, physiotherapy, you know. It's all working together to try and get the best out of these players for the next 3 months. And I doubt that there's too many players who are going to be able to play every game. So you know, it's a matter of adjusting the squad and determining who's ready to play and who's not. And that's where science comes in a bit. I think science can certainly help. I mean, obviously, I'm sure, you know, Jurgen, his staff will observe and talk to players and so on. But, you know, players aren't going to tell them that, you know, oh, I'm not feeling too flash today, you know, coach. I mean, you know, I think that's where sports science can really help. And there's a lot of data there that can show when people are, we can tell from, you know, heart rate data and GPS data and so on, you know, where players are overcooked and so on. So as I said before, I don't think they'll do much training. The players who are playing regularly are not going to do much training. Mm. They won't need to if they're playing twice a week. And then there's travel, you know, they're traveling in Europe and so on and so on. So it's hugely challenging, you know. One of the really important things that we haven't talked about is sleep. And sleep is just absolutely, I think we now realize more than ever how important sleep is. Yeah. And sleep is challenging. You know, I mean, you take last night, you finish the game at, 10 o'clock, you probably get home at, 11:30, you can't go straight to, you're not going to be imagine Connor Bradley is sort of buzzing for about
adrenaline, absolutely.
So
yeah.
You know, so that's challenging. And, you know, so in the old days, you know, you would have said, oh, well, they've got to be in at 9 o'clock this morning. Well, I'm sure they're not in at 9 o'clock this morning, you know. And so, you know, things like that is sleep is really important. And same when you're traveling, you know, on into Europe and so on, you're in strange hotels, you're on planes. I mean, that's a really important aspect. So a lot of time is spent on sort of sleep hygiene, sleep education, working out the best way to get adequate sleep. Mm-hmm. So that's really very important, I think. And then, yeah, just recovery in general is from games is going to become so important. Yeah. Get the nutrition right, get the fluids right, get the massage right, so that, 48 hours after one game, you know, you're ready to do a bit of quality training, you know, it might be a huge amount, but just do a little bit of training and then, you know, the next day you might play a game and so on. So, but there will be, you know, there's minor injury, you know, niggles and hopefully not too many serious injuries, but there's going to be wear and tear injuries for sure. And, you know, I don't think any player ever goes onto the pitch absolutely 100%, you know, feeling there's always, you know, a niggle here or some soreness or, aftermath of the previous game. And mm-hmm. so the more we can minimise that, the better. So there'll be a lot of maintenance work, you know, a lot of maintenance, massage, physiotherapy. The gym plays an important role, maintaining strength and so on. But they'll be off legs a lot. You know, they'll be in the pool a fair bit, on the bike, you know, just keeping their sort of heart rate up and not doing too much work on their legs. So it's, as I said, it's an art and a science. Yeah. And it takes a team approach. And the key to it is all working together. Mm-hmm. You know, if the science people think that they've got all the answers, or the football people think they're, you know, it's all combining our knowledge and our experience. And they've all had a lot of experience now. And so you take advantage of that and just get the best, the best result you can. It might be perfect. There'll be injuries, there'll be people who lose form, but, we've got to do what we can to try and maximise that.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned earlier on, like, the squad depth now at Liverpool, with the quality of players that are coming back as well, and the ones that have made their way back to training or in the squads or whatever it may be. Like, that feels, from a footballing point of view, that feels like a huge plus, really, because the squad isn't a skeleton squad anymore. You're not turning to the likes of Thiago in years gone by and asking him to go again and again and again. You can afford to take people out. If they are getting near to a red zone in training or whatever it may be, or they are showing signs of fatigue, you can afford to say, do you know what, I don't need to take a risk on you today. And I think the Europa League's been a bit of a blessing in disguise for that as well, because albeit Liverpool got the job done quite comprehensively, they didn't need to start their best 11 week in, week out to do so. I think that's been massive for Liverpool so far this season.
Yeah, I think so. And same with the Carabao Cup. And, they've played some of their better players off the bench and so on. So you just give them a little bit of a break.
Yeah.
But now, you know, things get serious now. So, you know, you can't do too much of that. But they're going to clearly rotate. And they're in a good position now because they've discovered a few extra players, haven't they? And which has been, terrific. And, you think when you lost TAA and Robbo, a couple of months ago, disaster, the other two have done well. So, it's a credit to the club that they were able to step up. They were obviously ready, and just sitting on the sidelines waiting. And that's a challenge, when players are not playing, to have them ready to go, maximum fitness, psychologically right, because it can be pretty depressing if you're not playing. Yeah. And so you've got to get the head right and the body right for those players. And who knows, there might be someone who doesn't play all year and then you get an injury and you need them for the Europa League final or the last game of the Premier League or something, and they've got to be spot on ready to go from a physical and a training point of view and mentally as well. So that's a huge challenge. So it's not just your top 11 or 13 or 14 players. You've got to have the whole squad, attention to the whole squad, and that's so important.
Well, therein lies the genius of Jurgen Klopp for me, because he's brilliant in every single facet of being a football manager. But for me, it's his man management and it's his ability to get everybody pulled in the same direction, whether they be part of the best 11 or otherwise. Because you're right, to call upon the lads that he's done in recent weeks and in years gone by and get them to come in and perform at the level required has just been, it's a skill, it's an art form essentially within itself. Just on that, Jurgen Klopp recently, they've turned back to a brains trust of neuroscientists, it says here, to help Liverpool's quadruple bid. I mean, this falls right into your wheelhouse, essentially. What do you make of that? What do you make of outside sort of influence or help, I guess, in terms of Liverpool? That's just marginal gains again, isn't Liverpool trying to get the advantage?
Yeah, I think so. There's plenty of expertise out there. I think we all call on, as a doctor, for instance, I would call on other specialists in particular areas, for instance, I'm sure that the science people do the same. I mean, none of us have all the answers, and that's when you get in trouble, when you think you have all the answers, and we can all learn from other people. On the other hand, you don't want too many opinions and so on. So, I think, you basically get input and get opinions from different people, put it all together, and then you put your own stamp on that and come up with a program. So, I'm a great one for getting picking people's brains, basically, you know, because, you know, I certainly don't profess to have all the answers, and you know, and no one does. But, you know, I know, I mean, we mentioned Darren Burgess before. He was always very good at that. You know, he would, you know, pick other people's brains the whole time on what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of the time they probably weren't doing as, you know, as much as him. But, you know, every now and then, look, you know, they're doing this and, you know, we should try this. And, you know, he'd look into it then and he'd do all the research and to say, oh, okay, yeah, we can, you know, adjust this a little bit or try this. So there's always, you can always improve. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when you get into trouble, the moment you say, yeah, you know, we're doing a fantastic job here and, you know, aren't we good, then that's when you get into trouble.
Well, that's where Jurgen Klopp's been at pains to say, pretty much throughout his Liverpool tenure, really, how all of the credit shouldn't land on his door. He's been stressing the importance of Pep Linders alongside him. In the backroom staff generally, Michael Edwards, when he was there and stuff like that, he's always, always, always been there, like I say, absolutely adamant that it isn't all his credit.
No, it's a team effort, you know, and you've all got to be pulling together. That's the secret. You know, you need team players off the field as well as on the field. And, you know, I've seen, you know, teams destroyed by, you know, people off the field with egos who, you know, think it's all about them, or, you know, playing little games, or, you know, I mean, you know, you've all just got to, you know, just swallow your ego a little bit and just say, you know, we're all in this together. You know, what can I, you know, the constant question is, you know, what can I be doing? You know, what can I do to make this team better, mm-hmm. you know, from a performance point of view, from an injury point of view, you know, that's your constant. You got to be every morning. You got to wake up and say, okay, what can we do today, you know, to make this team better? And there's always plenty of things you can do, you know. And whatever they're doing. Yeah,
I was going to say it's working.
Okay, aren't they?
Yeah, it's working at the minute. Long may that continue.
You know, the intensity. You know, I've watched a lot of football. I don't think I've ever seen a team play with the intensity that the Liverpool are playing with at the moment.
Does that change things from your perspective? But just finally then, because obviously, again, you've worked in different teams, different sports, whatever. Is the style of which a team goes about their business, does that influence your job? Because if you went to Man City, to use that obvious example, they play in a passive is harsh, but it's quite slow, they keep the ball, etc. Whereas Liverpool, it's feral, it's intense. Does that change your job?
Yeah, of course. You know, they can only do that if they have, you know, superb fitness levels. You know, you look at some, especially the forwards, you know, I mean, they're constantly sprinting, you know, and that's, you know, that's hard work. Yeah. And to play at that intensity that Jurgen wants to play with, the fitness levels have to be, you know, quite above, you know, the average team, certainly. And and I suspect that most of these players have taken their fitness to a completely new level, you know, that they've never thought they could get to or you know, thought it was important enough. But now it's just so important to play that way, you know. I mean, whether you're not, there are obviously different ways to play, but that's the way they play and you know, it seems to work. And, but to do that, you know, is enormously demanding, you know, and it's not surprising they get injuries. I mean, you know, the physical demands are more than any football team has ever done, really, I think. You know, I can't remember a team playing with the intensity that Liverpool play with. Now, they have for short periods of time, but Liverpool seem to be able to sustain it for 90 minutes, you know, and obviously they bring on, you know, their three or four subs at 65 minutes or whatever, which helps maintain the intensity. But it's you know, it's full on. And so that's a huge challenge for the fitness staff to get them to that level and then maintain that level without, you know, overcooking people and getting them injured and so on. So it's got to be a gradual process. You can't do this too quickly.
No.
You know, as soon as you do it too quickly, that's when you get into trouble. So it takes time. And then you don't have a lot of time pre-season. So there's a lot of challenges in going about this. But, you know, they've obviously they've done a fantastic job. I have to, you know, give credit to the fitness staff. I mean, they're really they deserve a lot of the credit, because without that, you know, that Jurgen couldn't play the way that he wants to play.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they deserve loads of applause. I quite agree with you. But yeah, just on Jurgen then, before I let you go, I could carry this on forever, by the way, you can probably tell. Speaking to a former fitness guy on cricket and football, this is literally my heaven. Just on Jurgen then, obviously we touched on it earlier on, he has announced he will be leaving. I mean, everything's been said. Superlatives have ran out for Jurgen Klopp essentially now, but it will be a sad old day because he's just been a phenomenal football manager, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, an outstanding person, you know, outstanding people person, manager. But look, I can quite understand why he's burnt out. I mean, it's massively demanding. And you know, I think, I don't think people Well, maybe as a result of this, they might appreciate the fact that the demands on a football team manager in a big club like Liverpool, but also the way he does it. You know, I mean, he's involved in everything. He's embracing everything. He's talking to, you know, sponsors, to fans, to players. I mean, he's constantly, I'm sure the club is constantly saying, oh, yeah, can you do this? Can you do that? You know, because he's the face of the club. And so it's so multidimensional. Mm-hmm. If you just sort of coaching a football team, you know, that's demanding enough. But all the other stuff that goes on, you know, how many press conferences does he do a week? You know, I mean,
too many for his liking, I think.
Well, I think they all think that. Yeah. But I mean, you know, constantly doing media interviews and so on. So there's, you know, there's never a break. And you know, as he pointed out, you know, over the summer, you know, you don't really have a break. I mean, they're planning things. They're so. I'm not surprised at all that he wants to take a break, and I think he's deserved it. And the pity is that he can't take sort of 6 months off and then come back. You know, I mean, the system doesn't sort of allow that really, or you know, you can't really sort of have a month off. You know, you could say you could have a month off, but you know, still he's so he does need to have a complete break. But I reckon after 3 months he'll be bored and want to do something. But
you can come back if he wants.
He needs that. But no, outstanding manager, outstanding person. What he's done for this football club is quite remarkable. So, he'll never be forgotten.
There you go, a full array of shows. I hope you enjoyed those little clips from all of them. If you want the full shows and, of course, a whole array of amazing Liverpool content, please do consider going to redmenplus.com and signing up. Or if you just want the podcasts in Spotify, search for Redmen Plus Podcasts on there and sign up through there.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.